right. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Georgia Prison News weekly radio show. We have a very special show lined up for everyone today. We're going to have Fani Willis, who is a candidate for the Fulton County District Attorney's Office. We're going to have her on here in just a few seconds. But before we start, normally every week we go over our COVID-19 numbers inside of the Georgia Department of Corrections. So at this time, I want to bring in my co-host, Susan Sparks, and she's going to give you the numbers or the latest numbers on the COVID-19. Susan, are you with me this afternoon?
I am. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. These numbers today are going to sound strange because they are strange. Yesterday, GDC reported, every day at 6 p.m., they reported a reduction in the number of staff cases at Lee State Prison, taking it from 20 staff to zero. I imagine that's not intentional, but it is what it, that is what they've reported, taking their number, their total down from 172 to 152. The inmate cases yesterday, GDC reported no change at 409 cases. However, that is not, that does not include the 18 cases that are at the private facilities, as well as the cases in the intakes, Jackson and at Lee Arendelle, where they are testing incoming inmates coming up from the county jails. And yesterday they did have a new case. This time it was the first female of the new, of the 139, I believe, females that have come in and been tested. There is a one positive case. They are bringing those cases total to 12 at the, among the intakes, which, following the numbers, 409 at the state prisons and the counties and so forth, the other facilities, 18 at the private, 12 intake. I don't get 409, I get 439, and pretty good at math, so that is what it appears to be. I do want to go back to something we brought up about 3 weeks ago for the first time, and that's the number that's predicted based on the number of staff cases. If you take the number of staff cases and multiply it by the ratio of total inmates divided by total staff, that number that's predicted is 939. And that's pretty long ways from 439. But it is, more than double. It is the predicted number, and that number aligns better with the conditions that are being reported around the state. So I realize that confusing and convoluted. It is posted on both They Have No Voice and the official Georgia Prison News page. And I guess if you read it, it may be easier to follow the numbers. Frankly, it appears to me to be likely that it's sloppy data entry, as well as, whether intentional or not, inaccurate reporting of the total inmates by simply pretending they aren't there. I mean, so that the official accounting by GDC of the numbers does not include the private prisons, nor does it include the cases that have been positive by testing at Jackson on the diagnosis and classification side, as well as Lee Arendelle. So I just have begun to call that magic math, and I hope that makes sense. That's about all I've got on that. Thank you.
All right, Susan, thank you for bringing that, bringing those numbers up for us this week. Is there anything else before we start our interview with Ms. Willis that we need to know that we learned this week, or and we don't have to go into it in great detail? Is there anything else that we need to just, you know, bring our listeners up to date on or anything like that?
There are some things that are, I guess, percolating around the state. Officers that aren't wearing masks, insisting, though, that the inmates wear their masks. Other cases where, locations where they've taken up the mask and then passed them back out. We've got reports of a number of issues going on because of the extremely low staffing. That seems to be quite a problem, and it's continuing. One prison reported that they had not had count but once in 3 months. Now, that may be an exaggeration, but it probably reflects some things that are going on. Pulaski this week saw its first cases likely to be COVID. Dorm E9 is where they were, and there were 3 inmates reported with high fevers, and that dorm, entire dorm's on quarantine now. Joshua and I have both stated all along that we thought that it was premature to begin all the transports that have been going on now right at 4 weeks. I still hold with that opinion, and the uptick around the state in cases, particularly cases that had done, prisons that had done a truly exemplary job of cleaning it, sanitizing, using masks, keeping inmates informed and reassured and calm. Those are now facilities that have active COVID going on. Really unfortunate, in my opinion, that people continue to get sick as a result of bringing in inmates from around the state. It was reported on Monday and Tuesday, I believe, maybe in Tuesday and Wednesday, that Coastal got a total of 6 buses from Jackson, and they went directly into the general population, so much for the quarantine. Additional cases reported at Rutledge that have not been reported otherwise, Hancock, Telfair, and Phillips both have the phones cut off there. It's the secrecy, the veil of secrecy that's been dropped down over the Department of Corrections is disturbing. Thank you very much.
All right, so Susan, thank you for that information, and we'll try to circle back around if we have some time left over at the end of the show. But I want to get this interview started with Ms. Fonnie Willis, and I'm not going to – I was thinking about it earlier. I'm not going to do a full introduction. I'll let her, because I don't want to mess anything up. But I want to start to kind of get into this Fonnie Willis interview, because – I think it's very important. Not only does the official Georgia Prison News and They Have No Voice deal with state prison issues, we also deal with incarceration matters also. And I thought it was very important. I think we're just now we're 3 days out from the election that will decide the next district attorney of Fulton County. And I thought it was important that we talk with some of the candidates, and we were able to speak with Ms. Willis, and she was gracious enough to come on the show and speak with us about some of the issues regarding criminal justice and some of the things that she'll bring to the table as district attorney of the largest county in the state of Georgia. You know, and so, Susan, I kind of wanted to, like I said, just talk to her and just see where she stands on some issues. I know that you have some questions. I have some questions as well. And so, you know, we're just going to kind of start this interview and see where it goes. Ms. Willis, are you with us this afternoon?
I am. Are you able to hear me?
I am. How are you?
I am amazing. I really appreciate you all giving me a voice on your show and allowing me to speak to your audience.
Absolutely. So I guess we'll start. Just give our listeners a little bit of information about yourself and exactly why you're running for district attorney of Fulton County.
Well, just to kind of start off, I have an undergraduate degree from Howard University, and I don't want to start any mess, but, you know, the best HBCU in the country. And I left Howard and came to Atlanta to attend Emory School of Law, graduated from Emory School of Law in 1996, immediately went out into a small law firm that was located on Cleveland Avenue in East Point, Georgia, and then set up my own law firm. Did the kind of law that most private practitioners do, did a lot of criminal defense, did some juvenile work, both guardian ad litem and representing children that were charged with delinquent acts. Also did some family law at that time. Did that for the first 4 years of my career, and then decided to go and be a city solicitor, which is the person that prosecutes city ordinance violations and misdemeanor crimes. Stayed there about a year and a half and then went on to work for the district attorney. I was there 16 years, 4 months, and 4 days, but you know who's counting. While there, literally went through every division. I've tried every kind of case there is, armed robberies, aggravated assaults, spent 8 years in the murder division and cold case. Also supervised the largest division of that office, which included 25 lawyers. I left in 2018. Very soon thereafter, I became the chief judge for the city of South Fulton. In March of this year, God put it on my heart that to run for the district attorney seat because I don't think he wants to see the corruption that's there a day longer. And so I did put my name in the hat in March of 2020. I would submit to your listeners that I am the only qualified candidate, and I'll be happy to discuss at length through your questions why I firmly say that, firmly believe that, and believe that your listeners, once they educate themselves to the race, that they will believe that as well. And of course, I would like their vote on June the 9th.
Wow, Ms. Willis, I'm Susan Burns. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure and a privilege, even. I have wondered with your background if you speak just briefly about where your own moral compass comes from.
Okay. I mean, you know, I was criticized by someone recently for saying that they were worried about my moral compass coming from God. Well, and it truly does. I am a Christian. My father is a byproduct of the civil rights movement. He was a civil rights activist. And my father raised me as a single father, and so he is the biggest influence on my life. And I would say my moral compass comes from my father, which his entire lesson of my entire life is that everyone is entitled to dignity. My father was put through some horrific circumstances being a black man in this country, but he never let that turn him to a hateful person. He never concentrated on kind of the injustices done to him by white officers or even white judges. His focus for me as a child was always on the white lawyers that came to help them. As a result of his experience of being incarcerated numerous times, and I'll get into some of that in some more specifics, he eventually became a lawyer because he said he noticed during the movement that it was always white lawyers that got them out of jail, and that was kind of a shame. And so he went on to law school, and, you know, lawyers reproduce lawyers. And so now you have Fonnie Willis as the byproduct of that. And so my moral compass comes from my daddy, and it comes from God.
Outstanding. You're speaking with a couple of Christians here today, and our backgrounds are diverse, but we come together on things that are especially important to us. I would love to know how you go about, if you become the DA, how will you go about, just would you like to see happen? Let me go with it that way. What would you like to see happen?
I just have to correct your question because words are important. You know, we manifest them in the universe. So when I become the district attorney, how we are going to change things, I think it has to be turned upside down. And I mean that literally. The office is completely broken. It has to be changed from the bottom up, and that's what I intend to do. Now the district attorney's office has what is called the complaint room. What happens is an officer makes an arrest, and the officer brings forth the evidence they have through that arrest. They bring it to the DA, and it is literally charged off of that information the DA had. People will criticize the officer for that arrest, but what I would tell you is I'm a studier and a lover of the law and probably even a nerd a little bit around it. What the law says is that an officer is to find probable cause, and if he does so, then he can make an arrest. I would submit to you what the officer has done, if he has at least that probable cause, is likely right. The district attorney has a higher responsibility. Before those charges the officer put on can get forwarded or any other charges, there should be investigation. There is literally not now. We are just processing the herd, treating human beings as if they are widgets. What I am going to do is create what is going to be considered a case intake unit. So certainly officers can bring their cases just as they do now. They'll have access to someone to talk to. But I'm going to put what I call my heavy hitters down there. I'm not going to put my baby lawyers that just got out of law school there. What I am going to put is my most experienced lawyers, probably somewhere between 12 and 15, and I can guarantee you it's going to be 15 investigators. The reason that I am going to do that is because cases can then get investigated. If they are investigated and we find that what the officer arrested you on, you've done, we're going to indict you. But what you're going to find so often is that once you dig a little deeper, that people do not really actually do what the officer said. Maybe they didn't do it at all and they shouldn't be charged. Maybe they did something, but it's really less. Maybe the person that claims they're the victim, really when you watch it all, they're the perpetrator. Cases are not like wine. They do not get better with time. And when you don't go out immediately and have investigators pulling tapes, here in Atlanta we have a tape on every corner, but what a lot of lay people don't know is those tapes are only good for about 45 days, and then they are taped over. At a liquor store or a convenience store, they are taping over every 24 to 48 hours because it's expensive to keep that tape. And so if someone doesn't get that immediately, it's forever lost. Witnesses' impressions are also better, closer to time. So you can get a more accurate picture of what happened if proper investigation is done on the front end. And so I'm going to have my office front end heavy. The other thing that I'm going to do from the initial on take is Fulton, sadly, in my opinion, is one of the few counties that does not have a diversion program that becomes before indictment is even laid down. What we know is once someone is indicted, it is very hard to get up from under that indictment, and it hurts you with things like student loans, with getting a job, etc. What we're going to find sometimes is the officer was absolutely correct. Johnny did what they said Johnny did. But to me, in my opinion, there is probably a segment of people that are charged for the first time that we as a society would be better served if we put them in a diversion program. Now, you got to pay back your ills you did to society. So certainly through that diversion, you're going to have to pay restitution to a victim. Certainly you're going to have to do community service. If you did harm in South Fulton, you're going to need to do your community service in the community you harm. If it was in Johns Creek, then you're going to need to do it there. I'd like to give class and educational pieces. And so I have been talking to some of the African-American preachers. I've been talking to community activists. I've been talking to regular citizens to ask me, will they help to pour into that program? The third thing that we could do from initial case intake is if it's not appropriate to charge, we're going to dismiss it. If it is appropriate to charge and it's egregious enough, we're going to charge it. If it's It would be appropriate to charge, but we decide we're going to put them in diversion, we would put them into diversion. There are also another bucket of cases that I think need to immediately be us utilizing our accountability courts. And those are the cases that you see of people that are mentally ill or are drug addicted people. Those cases will immediately go into those accountability courts. And in all full disclosure, they will be charged. The reason that they will be charged is to be able to have access to the accountability courts, you have to have an indictment. But what we will do is, just like with our diversionary program, once one completes that program, it's going to be a mandatory function of my office to go ahead and record restricted, or what people commonly call expungement, but the law has now changed. Also, we're going to do that process for people that complete accountability courts. But what I know is, if someone suffers with a drug addiction, you're, one, going to be able to look at their record and tell that, because they are going to be a repeat offender, but it's going to be for stuff like prostitution. It's going to be for stealing, because they're trying to feed that ill, which is what the prostitution is as well. And it's going to be for drug possession and drug paraphernalia. If you are an experienced prosecutor, it is easy to see a drug addict by looking at a copy of their record. My office will become trained to be sensitive to that, so that we can immediately track those people for a program, because as long as they have the addiction, we're going to have the crime as a community, and we're going to try to help those people to turn their lives around. The other thing is the people that will have mental health issues. If once you dig a little deeper, those also come to light, and they need access to programs. And so in that way, from the very foundation, the office of the DA is going to change. We're going to become an office that is about community. It is time to be an office of change. The current DA has lots of programs, but they're just words without meaning. They're not doing anything. It's time that we do something. The way business has been done is not worked, and it's time to do something different.
Ms. Willis, if I can jump in, because I kind of want to get your comments on a statement that Mr. Howard made last night, and since you have referenced Mr. Howard, then we might as well go ahead and address this. And it was
Let's
a quote that I saw. Yeah. And it was a quote that I saw in the newspaper last night, online last night. And it said, "I don't see how," and he was referring to you, Miss Willis, "can be the gatekeeper to community justice in our community when she has made a deal with the union not to prosecute police officers." And I want you to respond to that. And I think you did respond to it last night, but since you're on our show today, I want you to respond to that, because that was a serious allegation to be made against someone that's running for the one of the biggest offices in the state. So I want you to go ahead and respond to that.
Well, my pastor says make it plain, so I'm going to try to make it plain today. Mr. Howard is a liar, and he knows he is a liar. I would invite you to go back on my Facebook page, because over 1,000 people watched while I got the endorsement from law enforcement, and while law enforcement stood there and went in the interview with them, I made it very clear that anyone that does wrong, but especially the police, because they are sworn to protect and serve, we will be charging. But what you're watching is a desperate man, a man that is likely going to be indicted, make a claim that he knows is not true. But he is not a principled man. He is not someone of character, and he is not someone that you can believe. I wouldn't want the endorsement if that's what it required, but it is a disgusting statement. The worst thing for a good police officer is a bad police officer. I need my community, because there's going to be cases that aren't going to be popular, but this is the reality. I need my community to understand, when that lady finds the evidence, she indicts police officers. On case X, she said the evidence is not there, and she's not going to indict them. Police, just like Johnny, are going to get due process, which is why I say his case intake is so screwed up. Do you understand that as a result of him just charging people sit in jail for 3 months? It's not just a technical thing that happens. It has real-life consequences to real life human beings. But in a word, he's a liar. I never made such a deal. I invite your listeners for you to tag as many of you them as you can find for them to watch me accept that endorsement. But what you have is a person that is under criminal investigation for stealing $195,000 from the youth. What you have is a man that has two sexual harassment lawsuits pending, one gender discrimination lawsuit pending, another gender discrimination lawsuit that has already been settled and us, the taxpayers, paid $285,000 to. In addition to that, he is mad. I am endorsed by over 20 Democratic officials. I am also endorsed by Voter Pro-Choice. I am endorsed by the Georgia Association of Black Women Attorneys, and I am endorsed by the police. I am not here to be divisive. I am here to bring the community together. But to do that, I have to hold folks accountable, and I will hold them accountable.
Well, Ms. Willis, I wish you could see the physical reaction I'm having. I'm going, oh, yes. You are speaking to people who have strong opinions on charging, on the system. Most everyone who is involved in the groups that Joshua and I are in believes this system is indeed broken. And you have actually touched on a number of the questions I had written because as I prepared for this. I would love to hear your thoughts, your comments on overcharging of individuals, stacking the charges, and then if you can segue into a recidivism statute, we'd like to know your thoughts on both of those, overcharging and recidivism.
Okay, and first let me say this. Part of my time at the district attorney's office, I hit it on it a little bit, but I was the supervisor of what I call kind of the meat and potatoes unit. And what I mean by that is it was the complex case division. So that's your aggravated assaults, that's your armed robberies, that's your kidnappings, that's your burglaries, that's your drug trafficking. It's all of your more serious crimes, but not sex crimes and not murders. I had 25 lawyers that reported to me, and of course all their staffs, their investigators and their paralegals ultimately reported to me as well. One thing that I found and why I am so passionate about this is my unit did a lot of spinning their wheels because we were receiving these cases from the complaint room, and when they got to my desk, we're now 3 or 4 months later, which means somebody probably sat in jail 3 or 4 months, and my lawyer is going over the case with me, and I'm saying, what in the world? And I'm probably saying worse than that, but I'm cleaning it up. How did these charges get on this indictment? The facts don't make out these charges. Now, sometimes the facts made out some charge, but possibly it was a misdemeanor charge. Possibly it was a different felony, something of a smaller amount. Possibly it was a greater felony, but I didn't find that to be the case most of the time. What the philosophy of my office is going to be is to do justice, and that is why I am stacking the lower level of the, meaning the case intake unit of the office, with so many seasoned and qualified people, because we need to get it right from the beginning. And I don't want to portray myself as someone that's not going to prosecute crime. If you are a violent offender, or certainly if you have been someone who just terrorizes our community by doing crime over and over again, it's going to be my pleasure to make sure that we get you removed from our community so that we can be safe as a community. But I'm not going to overcharge it. As a DA, you know, I never played games. I would open my file to defense attorneys. My philosophy was always, if you can beat me within the file, then you need to, because I have to be able to go to sleep at night knowing that what I have done is justice. And that is the kind of lawyers that I want to bring in. As far as recidivism falls into two different buckets for me. The first bucket is the one that we discussed a little bit. Are in the recidivism, are we looking at the ills of someone that is suffering with mental illness and someone that is suffering from a drug addiction? To me, those are special people that we are here and we have mechanisms to help, and hopefully we can even grow as a community and put more mechanisms in place to help those people. Those people are going to continue to be recidivists until we get those problems under control. And so I don't believe in criminalizing mental illness. It's a sickness. I wish that people would recognize mental illness the way they do cancer. And so I want to treat it as such. And that is not to say we won't have to take restrictions to keep people safe, but it's a real illness. And I guess because people can't see it, they don't recognize it as such. So that is one bucket of recidivism. The other is the prosecution. Prosecutor in me. If you think it's okay to keep breaking in cars or stealing from a store and doing our property value, and we don't see that you're suffering with those ills, we're going to be tough prosecutors.
I understand that. Thank you. Joshua?
Yeah, Fonnie, I had a question, and like Susan said, I'm actually very much enjoying this and just enjoying hearing you talk on these issues. I wanted to kind of switch base to the and we had a few questions, and the majority of the questions were about the pipeline to prison and the probation violations and the individuals that are sent back to prison with probation violations. And I know probably like a lot of counties, and I'm not very sure about Fulton County, and you may know about this because you just left in 2018. But in a lot of counties, the majority of the jail population are individuals that has been violated for probation violations. What's your stance on the probation violation, and how are you going to kind of treat the probation violations and kind of maybe cut down on the pipeline to sending those individuals back to prison?
So that's a twofold question. The first thing, I think we need to deal with probation. My county, which is Fulton, is notorious for giving people what I think is too long of probation. You can't put people kind of in this will where you're on probation for 20 years, and that's not a made-up number. It's a number I've heard. So you're going to serve 5, and then you're going to do an additional 15 on probation or an additional 20 on probation. I think that that's basically a setup for failure. And so as part of my policy, we will not be doing long probated sentences like that, with one exception. The one exception to that rule is if someone owes a great deal of restitution. So you owe $200,000 in restitution, meaning you stole that much from a victim. You have to, on probation, pay back your money in half of the time that you were on the sentence. And so you have to make payments for someone to pay that back reasonable, and sometimes that would be a reason to cause probation to be long. So to the first answer to your question is I don't believe in extensive and very long probated sentences. I don't really understand why any probated sentence should ever be longer than 5 years. We need to make sure you have enough things that you do to correct your life within that time, and then we need to allow you to do those things to pay back society its debt and to go on with your life. So that's the answer to the first prong. The second prong, as far as revocations, is I am absolutely not going to allow my staff to revoke people from probation for issues of what I call poverty, because you could not pay your probation fees. We are not doing that. But on the other hand of that, I do think that probation is a privilege, because we could have offered you a sentence of jail, and instead what we said is we're going to give you a chance to be a productive member of society, and you are going to have to do these things. So in those cases, and you get them, and I'm not making this up, oh, you never even reported to probation. You didn't do 1 hour of community service. You didn't even try to get a job to pay back a dollar of this restitution. Those are going to be a different issue that we're going to have to look at on a case-by-case basis. But because we are going to really try to help probation and build people up and make sure, we're going to expect you to do your end of the bargain as well.
Right. And while we're talking about probation, and I want to touch on this because I know another one of your candidate that's running for the office as well has pretty much set his focus on this particular issue, and it's the cash bail issue, and he's vowed to eliminate the cash bail. What are your thoughts on the cash bail? Because you mentioned a violation of people that can't pay their probation, but what is your stance, or what will your stance be on people that just can't pay bail to get out of jail on nonviolent offenses and things of that nature?
On nonviolent offenses, I don't think that a cash bail is necessary. But where the young man that you're talking about has never tried a felony case, let me start there, which is, the first candidate, the incumbent, I say is disqualified because he just lacks integrity. You can't have somebody in office that does things for the camera, but when the cameras are off, they do the wrong things. I like to tell people what I believe to be true, that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I believe we have a DA sitting in office that has been corrupted absolutely. He does not mind lying. He does not mind taking from black and brown children. He does not mind sexually harassing people that work in his office. And I've listened to the tape and I've heard him beg for this woman's PU, and we'll let y'all finish that off. That is completely inappropriate. That is what disqualifies him. I also believe that this second candidate is disqualified. I think he's a young man with some great ideas, but this is the reality. You are hiring in this election someone to be the DA for the biggest office between Washington, D.C. and Miami. What is at stake is the tone of social justice for probably the entire country, but at least the Southeast. And so the policies we set, they are going to be very important, and they are going to be based on experience. So now let's take all of my experiences and talk about no cash bonds. He will say things like, I'm not going to give cash bonds for possession of marijuana. And I keep wondering, is he disingenuous, or does he really just not know? I'm the DA. I'm going to be prosecuting murders and rapes. We're not dealing with simple possession of marijuana. Do I not believe in cash bonds for theft by shoplifting, especially those caught by poverty? And it's very easy to see. When you look at files, if they're stealing food, you know, I try not to prosecute those cases, period. But then there's other cases where it's clear it's not poverty. It's just you wanted the $500 jeans that I can't afford either. So there are different – you have to look at – and that's why you have to look at cases individually. No, I don't believe in holding people in jail. And it's also a real practice. Reason. I hope your listeners understand, every person that we have in Rice Street, we are spending $90 a night to have there. So as a taxpayer, I don't want to pay $90 a night to have you there. What we could do instead is have people on an ankle monitor, because the purpose of bond is to make sure that you return to court. You then could only pay $10 a day. Guess what else? You could get a job while you're out, and you could pay your own $10 a day, so I, the taxpayer, doesn't have to. But even in that bridge where you don't have a job, even if the county was paying that $10, it is a lot cheaper than $90 a day. What I do, though, question that young attorney about is, in the case of murder, in the case of rape, if you go to these judges and you say, hey, we're not asking for no cash bail, what they're going to hear is, we're saying they could just sit in jail, period. Now, I represent people charged with the crime of murder, and quite frankly, I don't have any clients in jail right now. I got them out on bond. Now, they might be on ankle monitors and other things, but I do not want you to take that as a resource away from my clients, even charged with the most egregious crimes. And so I don't know that we can eliminate cash bond at every level.
Right, and that's going back to what we mentioned up top, and I wanted to be clear to the listeners, and like I said, I'm not, but I think it's made clear that and Miss Willis touched on this earlier. She's not talking about being soft on crime for Fulton County or whatnot. But I think what's important is that people have to start understanding that it's a new time, it's a new date, and the criminal justice system, I believe, in our country is broke, and that's on the county level, that's on the state level, and I kind of want you to touch on this, because I don't want people to get the impression that you're because you're for reform of these particular things, that you're actually trying to be soft on crime, or that you're going to be crime.
No, my career is one, we talked a little bit about it, but of that 18 years, I spent 8 years in the murder unit, and even longer than that in a job where at 2:00 in the morning, because that's when murders tend to occur, I had to get up out of my bed. Now, I have spent too many nights walking over people's bodies. It's not an experience of everyone, but it's my life experience. I have sat with so many mothers and cried because their child has been taken from this earth at the hands of another. I have watched that pain. And it's not things that I discuss often, but I have lived that pain. I have had family members that have been accused of homicide and convicted, and I have had family members that have been the victim of such and taken from this earth and taken from my family. I, by no means, am going to be excusing violent criminals. I am going to train up trial warriors. And one of the reasons that we are not going to be wasting resources on marijuana prosecutions and other things that just take up a prosecutor's time is because I want to use the resources of my office to focus on this gang violent problem we have of people getting armed robbed, and to focus on murders, and to focus on rapists. Like, people don't like to talk on child molestations. That's the ugly part of a DA's job, and we don't discuss it in polite conversation. But that's the kind of things my lawyers are going to have to deal with every day. Those are the kind of fact patterns that I have seen my entire life. And I'm here with my two daughters. I don't want them in our community, and I'm going to work hard to remove them. But we have to use the limited resources we have smart. And it is not smart to not try to rehabilitate and restore some people while we remove those that are dangerous from among us.
Ms. Willis, you are saying exactly how many of us feel. Even though most of the listeners are affected by the criminal justice system here in the United States, or here in the state of Georgia, that doesn't mean that we're separated from what's right, what's fair, what's just. We are concerned here about the to go back to recidivism, about the fourth felony causing the full sentence to be given without possibility of parole. And then, again, there is the life without parole, which is kind of keeps, I think we're around 1,800 people in Georgia prison system who have life without parole. And they have very, very little incentive to behave or to try to get out or to have an institutional record that's stellar. So would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that for me to give you a broad answer on that would be just to overstate something. I think that's where experience comes in. I would ask you, like, what are those four convictions? And this is the way that I will have my lawyers trained. What are those four convictions? Is it two, you know, assaults where they shot people in two different cases on two different times, and the third one was an armed robbery at gunpoint where they put a gun to the clerk's head, and now we're here for a fourth armed robbery? Well, you know, it is what it is. That is the way I feel about it. Are those four convictions, you had a theft by shoplifting, you got stopped with some, you know, some drugs, maybe you was a drug trafficker in your 20s. And so it's going to be a case-by-case scenario, and there's no way that I could tell you, oh, no, we're never going to use recidivism, because I wouldn't be telling you the truth. There may be some times where I look at you and that's what you kind of, you've earned it at this point. But there will be other cases that you look at those convictions and you say, I mean, we're not doing this. This is just unfair. It's unethical. And I'm not going to have lawyers that do that. But again, in those case evaluations, in that case intake, that is why you can't treat people like widgets.
That's good. Ms. Wills, we had a question from a listener. Would you be open to going back and reviewing cases that's brought to your office attention for possibly wrongful conviction?
Absolutely. I think that we're going to have to do that. I think that it is one of my duties to do. I think that the year 21 and 22 are probably going to be two of the hardest years of my life. We have to completely change a culture. We have to completely change the way business is done. And we have to correct some wrongs. And, you know, I hope that it doesn't sound crazy to you, but I believe that I've been called to do God's work. And to do God's work, I am going to have to correct some wrongs that have been done. But, you know, God believes in justice as well. And so there will be people held responsible for harm that they did to children, harm that they did to black and brown people. One thing as a prosecutor that I was always proud of is I didn't care how much education you had. I didn't care if you were white, black, polka dot, rich, poor, where your mama came from, none of that. I didn't care if they said you was turning tricks. I do not believe that people have the right to violate other human beings, and we are going to stand up for them. But I also do not believe that people that are charged with crimes are people that do not have value. People charged with crimes also have integrity. They also have value. They also have dignity. And I'm going to raise up a staff that understands that.
Wow.
Susan, you have I'll let you go ahead with the anything that you have next.
Actually, this has been a meaty conversation. I'm greatly appreciative of your willingness to field these questions. I've loved what I'm hearing, and in particular, I love hearing the passion. I don't believe last decade, at least, there's been that kind of show of passion out of the district attorney in Fulton County. And position, it's notable, it's powerful. That position is notable and powerful. It's a very important position because it has a lot of significant cases that come before it, and I love hearing that this top-down, or bottom-up, rather, philosophy. That makes sense to me in terms of my own experience in the industry, how you actually effectively deal with problems. And it does appear, as a lawyer like myself, not an attorney, that just his office is pretty well filled with problems.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I have signed up for a real job, but I'm up to the task. I truly believe, and I tell people this, that my life experiences, both my personal life experiences and my work experience, that I truly believe that each of those experiences was to prepare me for this, which I believe is my destiny, and I believe we're going to make great changes in my county. I think that we are going to be the star prosecutor's office. I ask people to be patient with me, but I ask them to hold me accountable.
Ms. Willis, before we go, and I'm sure you have, because I think while I was researching and doing some research, it was last week or the week before. Have you visited a state prison or anything like that recently? I think I saw a picture of you somewhere, but I can't remember.
Absolutely. I have a client that I represent out of DeKalb County that was convicted at 17 years old that for murder. He was a party to a crime, to a murder, or the allegations. I represent him on a habeas. And the picture I think you saw is when we were out there, I was down there arguing his habeas. And those experiences touched me because this is the reality. When I go to prison to visit him, and I'm not going to say his name, but other clients, as I have to go to Rice Street and local prisons to see people, it's too many people that look like me in there. And there's something wrong that's going on, and there's something that is broken. And we've got to fix this. We can't keep sending my men away.
Right. And my hope would be because, and people hear it a lot, and, you know, me and Susan has discussed this as well, and my hope would be, when as you said earlier, let's go ahead and speak it into existence, when you become DA, a lot of times when these individuals go in front of the judge to be sentenced, you know, there is a belief among, and you probably will agree with me, there's a belief among some judges that the prison system is the only place where these individuals can go and be reformed or whatever the case may be. So, you know, it'd be my hope that once you become district attorney is that, you know, you will when it is possible that to show grace and, you know, give alternate routes to prison that, you know, you'll step up, your office will step up and actually do that, because I think, you know, the prison system is just not the answer, and I would hope where it could be done that, you know, just some alternate routes are put in place before, you know, it's automatic prison, if that makes any sense.
I absolutely agree. I agree with you that prison is definitely not the answer for a lot of the crimes we see. You know, I'm not somebody that doesn't believe that prison should exist. We have people that we have got to remove from society for our safety, but I definitely agree with you that it is an overused tool. But in this transition, one difference between me and the current district attorney is he truly believes that he is the only great mind. I know that I don't know everything. I know that I need help and conversations with people like you and other people in the community that are really advocating. I am going to ask you all to give me those ideas and to keep talking to me. What I want you to know about me is we're not going to agree on every conversation. We're going to have real heated disagreements. But what you can know is that I'm honest. If I tell you I need some time to think about it, you're going to get an answer after I think about it. If I tell you I'm not doing that, you're going to walk out the room and say, she's not doing that. If I tell you I'm going to do on it, you can rely on it. And that is going to be the great distinction between me and the current DA. Doesn't mean you'll be happy with every decision, but it at least will be an honest conversation between us, and you can count on it.
All right. Susan, in the closing moments, and we'll give Ms. Willis a last pitch, if you may, for just the listeners out there. But, Susan, do you have any other questions or comments before we give Ms. Willis the last the opportunity to just give the listeners anything about it?
Well, as I was preparing this, I tried to read what I could, and one of the things that I read said that the fundamental responsibilities are to investigate, that the powers are investigate, subpoena, file charges, plea bargain, and to grant immunity. And those are sweeping powers. So I'd love your comments on the power and the use of power.
I think that it is a – I hope that your listeners are really paying attention, because what I would tell them is that the district attorney probably, in my opinion, and I could be a little biased, it touches more people's lives than any other position. All of us have been the victim to a crime, have been a witness to a crime, know someone that has been charged with a crime, know someone in prison, know someone who's been murdered, someone that's been raped, all of us. There's no one in society. You have to have someone in that position that uses that power compassionately, that uses that power justly, that uses that power to truly do what is right, when it's not the CEO, son, but it's the person you don't even know, son, that they, when no cameras are on, are trying to do what's right, not to get notoriety, but to actually seek justice and to get what is right. I am telling you and I am committing to you that I am that human being, that there are going to be many hard days ahead for me, and I'd ask you to pray for me, that God gives me wisdom and the ability to continue to be compassionate. But the current DA has just long ago decided that the office was about him and not about the people. I want you to keep telling me it's not your office. This seat belongs to us. And I promise to keep working very hardly, to keep being compassionate, and to keep remembering that the people in the files that are victims, the people in the files that are witnesses, and the people that are in the file as charged individuals are all human beings and all have value. That's the commitment that I can make to you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. It was a pleasure for you all to have me today. I just really, really appreciate it, and I hope that your listeners have learned a little bit more about me, and I would just ask them on Tuesday, June 9th, 2020, you know, our forefathers died so that we could have the right to vote. Please exercise your right to vote, and if you live in Fulton County, please vote Fonnie Willis for Fulton County's next district attorney.
All right. Ms.
Wow.
Willis, thank you again for joining us. And as Susan said, bringing your passion, it was we really appreciated it. And we believe that, you know, we like to cover a lot of issues here on our show. And, you know, it was a little different today because we kind of dealt with, you know, the county side of things instead of the actual the state side of things. So, you know, it was definitely a pleasure to have you on our show. And, for us, I know you're very busy, you know, with the election coming up. So, again, we just want to thank you. And hopefully when you win, you know, you'll come back and kind of give us some more.
That's a promise. That's a promise. Y'all got to let me sleep about 2 or 3 days, and then I'll be back.
all right. So, again, we thank you for coming on, and we'll be watching on Tuesday and see kind of seeing how things go.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Wow. Susan, that was great. You know, that's something, Susan, that, you know, that we got to start. And, you know, and I know that, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, that's just the politician talking and, you know, or whatever they may say. But, you know, we got to start. I'm a firm believer that if we're going to change our criminal justice system, that we got to start. That's going to be with the judges and the district attorneys that we elect. That's where the change is going to come from in our – this is where change is going to start in the criminal justice system. So to hear her speaking like that, it gave me some reassurance that that's possibly. And, you know, and that's just one county, but, you know, it's the biggest county in the state. And I think that that can possibly be a starting point on some of the things, on some of the stuff that we face in our criminal justice system and where we're going to start trying to find some change. You know, so that was a great interview. What are your takeaways, Susan, from what we just heard?
You know, I fervently hope that all around the state of Georgia, people who are running for DAs bring that same passion to the position. We have so many people, you know, Georgia is a large state. I mean, geographically, it's a large state and it's populated. So we have people who have stories from particularly rural counties where there is a lot of relationships that exist that tend to supersede the law. And we hear some stories that are just simply heartbreaking, where people are essentially railroaded because the DA is the uncle of the judge or whatever. I'm very impressed with the passion, and I hope that the other people running for the same office in other counties bring that same passion. They may have different problems to solve, but I think we would all agree that our loved ones who are in the prison system got there at a county level first. The county,
right.
Them.
Right. And like I said, I think it's important to, you know, just to point out that the current DA in Fulton County, and like I said, we're not endorsing anyone, but we do recognize the issues with the current DA, Mr. Paul Howard, in Fulton County, and all of the issues that Ms. Willis pointed out, and all the unfairness that his office has speared off through the years. And I didn't bring it up with Ms. Willis, because I know that she was a part of that office for a number of years. And I didn't bring this up on this basis is because, you know, some of those cases were, you know, there was a lot of issues. Ms. Willis was in a different division and didn't have, you know, the direct knowledge of just some of the cases that, you know, just got some bad raps or a lot of people that were treated unfairly. You know, I think she made it plain that, you know, she was in the major case division that handled a lot of murders and a lot of the high crimes. So I didn't think it was fair to mention, you know, some of the stuff, some of the questions that I received for Ms. Willis. But, you know, Susan, like I said, getting back to, you know, just upcoming election on Tuesday and, you know, all around the country and all around the world, there are going to be elections for district attorney. And like I said, I don't want to keep beating a dead horse, but, you know, I do think that, you know, it's very important that, you know, if we got to start seeing change in those criminal justice system, you know, and, you know, the change starts with the, as I said a minute ago, the change starts with the DA and the judge that we elect to give justice to, and as Ms. Willis said, to the victims and the person that's, you know, named on the indictment. You know, so we have to start electing judges and district attorneys that's going to do swift justice and fair justice to these individuals. And, you know, Susan, I hope that people will, if you're in Fulton County, that you'll get out on Tuesday and vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but, you know, it's very important that you get out and that you vote for district attorney and whatever, whoever else is on the ballot, state representative, you know, representative that'll be going to Washington. It's just a very important election. And like I said, we have to start voting for these individuals, you know, so we can start trying to change our system. There's a lot of things that's going on in our system right now. And we just have to continue to, you know, bring those issues out to the forefront and to bring those issues to light because they're important. Susan, you got anything you want to add?
No, you said that so well. These county positions, well, you remember Chip O'Neill said all politics is local. These county positions are what's driving our state Department of Corrections. Got a problem in that the Board of Pardons and Paroles puts a jug, basically chaps it so that people don't get out. As long as we're driving people in to the prison system, there needs to be an outlet for them, and that's a different issue that doesn't have to do with this election. But it does indeed have to do with elections. Those are appointed positions, and they matter. But this starts our problems that our listeners are dealing with today at the county level. It's very important.
Right, and like I said, Susan, since we're on this topic and we still have, you know, a little bit time left, and I won't say the name because I don't. But I was actually watching, and this is just piggybacking off what you were saying, Susan. There's a candidate that's running for Congresswoman. I think she's running for Congress. And it was brought to the attention in a forum a few weeks ago that while she was mayor of the county that she or the city that she was. I think it was Columbus. I think she was mayor of Columbus. But it was brought to the light that she was actually using the – and Columbus has a county facility, a county camp facility there, and she was actually using the inmate prison population to do major things around the county, major projects around the county. And, you know, and we know, and a lot of the listeners that may not know that's still listening and still with us for the Fannie Willis interview may not know that these individuals that are prisoners are sent to county camps, and they're most of the time, 9 times out of 10, they're state prisoners. They're sent to these county camps, and they're sent to these towns and these cities, and they're working for free, and they're actually doing labor. Free labor for the counties and the town. So it was brought to the attention that she was a firm supporter of this, you know, this free labor from the prisoners. You know, and that's one of the things, and that goes back to what Susan was saying. That goes back to the things that, you know, we have to know what these individuals that's running for office stand for, you know, and we have to weed these people out, because I don't think anybody would agree that using prisoner labor free and for counties or cities or whatever the case may be, you know, I don't think anybody would agree that using these individuals for their services, and then, you know, they're working free of charge, and the county and the city is profiting from this labor or whatever that they're doing. And it's not just going on in Columbus, it's going on in all of this all around the state of Georgia, where prison labor is being used, and these individuals are not being compensated for the services. You know, so those are issues that, you know, these individuals that's running for office are agreeing with, and, you know, they may not be running on that platform, but, you know, you have to research these individuals and see what they stand for, because, you know, I don't personally think that, you know, they should be benefiting from labor or services from prisoners. But that's a topic for another show, you know, down the road. Susan, you have anything?
No, Joshua, I wholeheartedly agree with where you are on that, that we are actually talking there about a 14th Amendment issue, that slavery. I don't like to say the word sometimes, but that is what it is. It's forced unpaid labor. A fantastic conversation to have, because it's intricately woven into all but many of the county governments in Georgia. Those state camps exist to the county, and I can tell you that at Floyd County Prison, that's the one I know the most about. About 400,000 man hours per year, Floyd County. 400,000. Let's call that $10 an hour that is saved. That's $4 million in labor. And some of the things that go on at these at the county camp, some of the labor that's provided, you might be surprised at what it entails. Another day, a different civic issue, but it comes down to these elections absolutely do matter. A lot of people don't think about it until they have someone in their family or that they love who is incarcerated.
Right, and I think we need to learn these their positions when it comes to their state. If we're dealing with a state level, or if we're dealing with you know, someone running to be a congressman or congresswoman for the state of Georgia, that's going to be going to Washington D.C. We need to know their position on matters, specifically for prisons, you know, and because there's lobbyists out there, and, you know, they vote on certain bills, and they'll vote on certain bills that, you know, for lobbyists when it comes to the private prisons, and, you know, and they'll go to, and, you know, we have state representatives who, you know, who don't, I call it neglect, you know, when they get into office. They neglect the prison system, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that would be different if these representatives and these you know, for on the state level, would be more involved in our prison system and our criminal justice system in whole in Georgia, you know. So there's we in our groups, and they have no voice in Official Georgia Prison News and whatever other advocacy groups there is out there. We have to make sure that we start asking and learning these individuals' positions on criminal justice matter and the state prison matters in our state. Because, Susan, and I know you'll agree with this, there's a lot of stuff going on in our prison system right now. And I'll put this out there. Our current governor has appointed an individual over our prison system who doesn't care about that. It's obvious that he doesn't care about the department that he runs. So we have to start electing officials that's going to start to try to clean this up, to clean our prison system up, because right now it's just not working. The governor has given, I think, sole priority to the parole board on how to run our prison system. And the parole board answers to no one. They're not elected officials. They're not, anyone that, has to answer to anyone. So, I don't want to beat that horse too long, but Susan, I'll let you jump in and kind of, if you have anything on that.
There's actually something that my son had gone to prison and come home before I found out that there's a board of corrections. It consists of 18 people plus the commissioner, and they have monthly meetings unless they cancel them, which happens regularly, actually. And from the minutes of the meeting, of the Board of Corrections meetings, you would be hard-pressed to see any impact being made by that board. It's very difficult to see it as anything other than a rubber stamp for the commissioner. He comes, when they have the meetings, he comes to the meeting, he brings his minions with him, about 20 people come with him, and he gives a report to the Board of Corrections. That report does not become part of the minutes. We can't see that report because, after all, it's a state secret. We've got problems when everything is a secret and things go on behind the walls that are appalling. We have problems here, and our governor, you spoke to it, our governor has a hands-off approach to the prison system, and it's problematic in every respect. Just from the perspective of our fellow human beings, the mistreatment that goes on, the crime that goes on, the unsafe conditions are appalling, and nothing is ever done about it. It only gets worse. One might even conclude that the prisons are out of control in Georgia.
All right, and I think we're seeing evidence of that right now. I mean, our governor's priorities and our governor's tactics of dealing with this system is totally wrong. He's given he stripped his own power away from himself and given it to the parole board and the corrections department itself. Yet he's failed to act on the major shortfall in staff at these facilities. And we're starting to see riots. We're starting to see an uptick of violence. There's been videos in the last few weeks of just unacceptable behavior on the part of staff and I'll say this, unacceptable behavior probably on some of the offenders part as well, but we have a governor who priority is, or his priorities would appear to be forget the system, the prison system, and these institutions, and let's focus on making an appearance of tough on crime and let's make it appear that he's going to be the law and order governor of the state of Georgia. And that's the and we saw this last weekend when we saw the governor call in, and I think I counted probably 30 to 40 officers who are a part of the technical squad of the Georgia Department of Corrections. He called them in to a peaceful protest going on in Savannah to appear as a tough on crime and a tough on, you know, a law and order governor. He called in this unit of the Department of Corrections to go to a peaceful protest. And we actually heard from people who lived in Savannah in both of our groups that there was nothing going on in Savannah. It was a peaceful protest. There was, you know, there was no need for an additional call in law enforcement. Yet the governor, who wanted to appear tough, decided to send this special unit in, where we have facility after facility in Georgia. I think it's over 90 facilities in Georgia, who's short on staff. Who doesn't even have officers working buildings. Who has officers? You know, that's you have one officer working four or five buildings. You know, so that just goes to show, right there, where. You know, his priority is when it comes to prison. So, like I said, you know, what can we do about this? We have to vote. We have to start holding our appointed officials accountable. And we have to, you know, just we have to and the candidates for these offices, we have to see where they stand on these issues, because they're very important issues. And people may not right now, they may not have, you know, anyone incarcerated in a county or state facility. But, you know, anything can happen, you know, and we have to be ready to for these issues, you know, the current issues and the issues that will arise, you know, in the future. So, you know, our corrections department is broken in the state, and, you know, we have to start coming up with ways to fix these issues. So, Susan, I'm not trying to preach this morning, you know, but as we start to close out the show, give the new listeners who are still with us from the Fannie Willis interview, just give them a brief description of the work that you do in advocacy.
Yes, indeed. I like Ms. Willis, I do believe that I am involved in this because of God's hand in my life. He has put me here. In fact, I probably was kicking and screaming to avoid it, but it is where I found myself and found kind of a niche where the things that I do well can be utilized to help other people. At They Have No Voice, we are truly trying to give a voice to the inmates. We've had something last week that happened, it actually happened week before last, with getting just a terrible mayonnaise problem. Mayonnaise out of the system, and they did. And as it turns out, they only withdrew the mayonnaise, but other products are being still served from that same company. So I'm not through with that. But we're trying to approach the ways that we advocate in a number of directions. We write to our elected officials, to our Georgia senators and House of Representatives members, and write to them regularly. They probably roll their eyes when they see those emails, but it's how we give a voice to those who are behind the walls. We are advocating every single day. Someone asked me last night, do I ever take a break? And I take a nap once in a while, but pretty much this has become all consuming, and I am compelled by the problems we see in this prison system, and I am very concerned about the tendencies we're seeing now, the bubbling up of the violence, and even we've gone 3 months now with no visitation for inmates in Georgia. And then to add misery to that, some of the prisons have cut off the phones, cut off the emails. I saw a picture today. Someone sent me of their loved one's letter that was mailed to them that had been opened. And, you know, usually they've got that stamp on the back that it was examined by fluoroscope or something, whatever it says. But this had been opened and resealed with White Rain labels off of shampoo bottles. I mean, are they out of tape? The letter was like 2 weeks late getting to the family. And it's late going the other way as well, going from out here inside. But cutting people off from being able to communicate what's going on inside makes me kind of squirrely about what's going on in there. We need transparency, and we've got none at this point.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, only thing I think at this point, Susan, is we have to continue doing what we're doing. Requesting change and bringing things to their attention and putting things out there for the public to see and the public to know, this radio show and the various groups on social media. And, we have to hold their feet to the fire and make sure that, we're trying to, and to make sure, that, our voices are being heard, that there's people out here that's not just fighting for just one individual, but fighting for all the individuals that's incarcerated in our prison system. Doesn't matter what they've done. They were sent to jail or they were sent to prison and jails to serve a sentence, and these individuals are serving their sentence and, their sentence. I think I told someone yesterday, I made a comment to a lady who said some things on some of the treatment that her son was being, how he was being treated. It's very important to know that sexual assault is not a part of the sentence, and having your rights violated or was not a part of the sentence that the judge or the jury handed down. We have to continue to be the beacon and to voice these concerns. That's one of the reasons, Susan, that I like the Facebook groups, because the family members and the loved ones can go in these groups and they can give us an update on the facilities. It's not us, me and you and the other advocates that's out here. It's working. It's the loved ones who sometimes the people, the prisoners themselves that, pass this information along to us. And, it's our job to get that information out and to, do the best that we can with trying to change, something in our system. So, Susan, give our listeners your group information and how they can contact you in the future and anything else in the closing moments that you'd like for them to know.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I'm the founder of They Have No Voice. It's a private group, and the privacy actually matters because what you say in that group is not visible to the public. But They Have No Voice. We're in the process of converting this from simply a Facebook group and a forum in order to be even more effective with the activities that we're involved in. I truly mean it, that we're there to give a voice to those who have none. And you can reach me at Susan Sparks Burns on Facebook. I'm easy to reach, and I try to be transparent myself in who I am and what I'm about. I'm not an attorney. I am just an old retired lady with a computer. And,
Go ahead.
This is for those who have people involved in the system or who are interested in seeing some social change.
Right. So
reach
join. Look up that group on Facebook. Please have a accurate and consistent profile. Facebook profile, that way we can verify who we're allowing into the official Georgia Prison News group, and also the They Have No Voice group. Official Georgia Prison News group is this. We work with They Have No Voice and correspond with that group, and a lot of our members are pretty much the same, but we have different members and a diverse group of people from all backgrounds who have loved ones in and loved ones that were formerly in, and we have loved ones, just people of all backgrounds in both groups. Neither one of us advocates to be an attorney, so please don't get that twisted. We don't advocate to be attorneys or legal aid or anything like that, but we do work with loved ones and family members to lead them in the right direction on how they can confront the issues that their loved ones and friends and family members face. So, I just wanted to put that out there real quick to, just close that down if it even is anybody just ever thinks that. But anyway, Susan, I thank you for being a part of our show this week. I don't know what number show this is. But we're going strong, and I appreciate your help with all the issues that we're facing and the things that we're doing, and thank you for helping our ladies and men that's behind those fences and behind those walls in this state, and we're going to continue to fight for them, and going to continue to give them a voice. So I appreciate y'all that you do for being with us every week, and we'll hopefully talk with you again next week and see what we can come up with then.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joshua. Great to be with all of y'all today. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
All right, well, that's going to do it for us this week on the Georgia Prison News show. We want to thank all of our new listeners, and we want to thank Attorney Fonnie Willis, who is running for District Attorney of Fulton County. We hope that you will join us again on next Saturday at 12 noon for our next show. Don't know what we'll be talking about just yet, but it will be informative, and we hope that you'll join us. And we want to thank everyone that's listening now live, and thank everyone that'll go back and listen later. Until next week, my name is Joshua Randolph, and I want to thank you for listening to the Georgia Prison News Radio Show.